starting a new series today, and it is based on a book by Tim Keller named The Reason for God. Tim Keller does a wonderful job in this book of addressing some of the bigger issues that people wrestle with in regard to belief in God, and he does it in a very objective and respectful and thoughtful manner. And I hope that that's how we can do it as well. Going to be 7-8 weeks, not sure yet. It's kind of developing itself as we go. But I'm encouraged by it, and we're watching some videos in Sunday school that kind of parallel it. It's from a 10-week thing called H2O that explores issues of faith. And so if you haven't been in a while, come and join us. So I'm excited about the new start of the series, but I want to lay some ground rules. We need to have some ground rules just so that we know where we're headed. First, everyone lives by faith in something. I'm going to be talking about and addressing some of the bigger issues that people wrestle with. And sometimes you'll run into someone who says, I'm just not a person of faith. But the reality is we all live by faith in something. If you go to work with the faith that at the end of that pay period they're going to pay you, you're living by faith. Okay? Sometimes we associate faith with just a certain part of life, but in reality, we all live it by it. If you get in the car and drive, you're living by faith because you're trusting that the other people on the road are going to the best of their ability, follow the rules of the road, and you're going to make it home. Okay, so all of us live by faith. But if you believe in A, you may not believe in B, but all of us live by faith. Secondly, most people, I believe, have never really thoroughly thought through why they believe what they believe. When our guys turned 13, Susan and I challenged them that they needed to develop their own faith in God. Most kids develop what's kind of inherited. Many of you have inherited what was a part of you being brought up in this church or another church. It's just kind of an inheritance. And we challenged our kids, you need to ask your questions and develop a faith that is yours, because it can't be based on us. It has to be a relationship between you and God. So hopefully we will challenge you to think through some things that maybe you haven't. Also, faith and doubt are not mutually exclusive. Sometimes we think that it's one or the other, and it's not. In Mark chapter 9, there's a father who comes to Jesus to request healing for his son. And says, everything is possible if you believe. And the man responds this way. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And I think that's a marvelous statement, because it demonstrates that it's not an either or. It's an amount of what we have more faith in. For example, in college, I generally did not ask a girl out on a date unless I believed more than 50% that she was going to say yes. Okay, makes sense? But I never had 100% assurance that she was going to say yes. So I felt pretty good, but there was still that doubt she could say no. Okay, same thing with issues of faith. It's not an either or. It's a matter of what we believe in and trust in more. Okay. Also, there is no way to completely answer every question with the scope of the sermon series that I'm going to give you today, the following week. We can't cover everything. For some of you, I'm going to be covering territory that you're going to be thinking, gee, I've already settled that issue in my head. Just get on with things, okay? I want to encourage you to stay with me, because chances are you're going to run into somebody who maybe is still wrestling with it. And so it's going to be good for you to be able to know how to respond to them. And some of you, when we get done, you're going to be saying, gee, you just barely scratched the surface. I have so many other questions. That's good. That's healthy. And if you will get with me, I can help you sort through that, or I can recommend some resources that will help you go further. Okay? It's sort of like when you teach math to 30 kids. They're not all at the same place in their journey. You kind of have to hit the middle ground and give more attention in either direction. So that's what I want to encourage you about. We are all in different places in our journey of faith. And lastly, regardless of where a person is in regard to their particular beliefs, everyone deserves to be treated with respect. In the last chapter of Matthew's gospel, we see a remarkable statement, Matthew 28, verse 16 and 17. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. This is just before Jesus leaves to go back to heaven. Verse 17, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Did you ever notice that before? They worshipped him, but some doubted. We know that all 11 went on to have an incredible impact for God's kingdom in the early church. But what this shows us is that they were all at different places in the journey. Some of them were ready to worship God, Jesus, and some were still wrestling with some doubts, even though they could see him risen from the dead. So we need to understand the importance of being a safe place for everybody. It needs to be okay. You probably, if you've lived long enough, you have probably been in one of those situations. I have, where you ask a question and you get treated disrespectfully. People laugh or snicker, and you feel belittled. And that's very frustrating, and it shuts people down, okay? And I'm kind of a piranha when I see that happening, okay? So if you're going to do that to people, do it away from me, because I might just jump all over your case. Because I believe it's very, very important for us to be a safe people for others to be able to explore and have whatever question they have. There are only two stupid questions in the whole world. One is the question that never gets asked, and the other is to ask a mother of young children if she works. Okay? Other than that, all questions are good. Now, today we're going to be exploring this book that we call the Bible. It is our guide. At first, Israel, and then the church became known as a people of the book. And Paul says this in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 16, 17. Every part of Scripture is God-breathed and useful one way or another, showing us truth, exposing our rebellion, correcting our mistakes, training us to live God's way. Through the Word, we are put together and shaped up for the tasks God has for us. But the foundational question then becomes, can the Bible be trusted? Is it reliable? Is it relevant for today? Thoughtful people have a lot of questions about these different issues, and it's an important place for us to start in the journey. Now, in case you're thinking, well, this applies to somebody else, let me ask you this. Have you ever read something in the Bible that left you scratching your head or that you didn't understand? Okay, if you haven't, chances are you haven't read it through, because there are parts that everybody runs into that make you stop and question, what are they talking about? So you're in good company. We're going to sort through some of the reservations that people might have. Now, there are seven total. I'm only going to do three today because I don't have time to do all of it. And for this first part of it, there's a bit of background information that I can't, it's not a story form. I can't just verbatim tell it to you. I have to share it because it's stuff that the guys are quoting and research and numbers and things. I think it's very fascinating, but you're going to have to work to stay with me a little bit because it's not a story of, you know, broken feet and all that kind of stuff. Okay? So stay with me, and if you need to get a transcript of this to read through it again, you can do that. You'll be able to listen to it on my blog in a couple days. But reservation number one is this. I think the Bible may have valuable moral insights, but it ought to be understood as a collection of myths, fables, once upon a time kind of stories. Ever heard anybody express that, or are you there? Do you have that sense that it can't really be trusted? It's more a collection of stories and fables. Now, what we call the Bible is really not one book, but rather 66 different books written by dozens of authors over centuries. In fact, over 1,000 years. Imagine someone starting a book 500 years before Columbus and then have it finished in our day. That's the length of time over which the Bible is written. What in the world could tie that together? And no wonder there's a little bit of things, there are things that cause us to be curious that don't quite fit, that we don't quite understand. But one of the things that binds them together over such a long period is the conviction that there is a God and that he is not silent, but that he has revealed himself in human history, particularly in the history of Israel. This is what made the scriptures of Israel radically different than other ancient writings, like from the Sumerians or the Egyptians. They took seriously the idea that God had revealed himself in history. In fact, one author, Barak Halpern, says that Jews invented the writing of history. Take just one statement from one author, the writer of the Gospel of Luke, who wrote Luke? Luke. The hard questions come later. I'm just kind of making sure you're still with me, okay? The author of Luke was Luke. The author of Matthew was Matthew. The author of John was John. Okay, you're doing good. Okay, you're with me. So from this one excerpt from Luke chapter 3, he says this, describing the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist, about the time that Jesus' ministry starts. In the 15th year of the rule of Caesar Tiberius, it was while Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, ruler of Galilee, his brother Philip, ruler of Iturea and Trachonitis, Licinius, ruler of Abilene, during the chief priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, John, Zechariah's son, out in the desert at the time, received a message from God. You notice the incredible detail that Luke gives about the historical surroundings, who's doing what? Why does he do that? Because he wants us to understand this is not a once upon a time story. This happened. This is historical. It really took place. Now, people who read much of ancient literature will tell you, you don't get that kind of detail in fairy tales and fables. It just doesn't exist. But then it lends itself to the other question, is it accurate? Luke gives all these details, all this historical reference, is it accurate? Okay, here are a few things that I found extremely interesting, and it's instances where the Bible is confirmed by external sources. What that means is something outside of the Bible is verifying that it's accurate. For a long time, people who were skeptical about Jesus cited this Luke 3 passage as a problem. Luke mentions Licinius, and he's known to have lived 50 years earlier, to have had a different title, and to have been a ruler in a town called Chalcis. So there were people who said Luke cannot be trusted as a writer in history. But that was until the 20th century. Archaeologists found an inscription that was written during the reign of Caesar Tiberius, which was 14 to 37 AD, that refers to Licinius being the tetrarch of Abilene. It turns out there were two Licinius's, and that Luke got it exactly right, and we didn't know it, that it was confirmed in history until the 20th century. Interesting, huh? Other places where the New Testament gets confirmed, in Acts chapter 18, Luke is also the writer of Acts, we're told Paul was taken before a proconsul of Achaia named Gallio, and then inscription is discovered in Delphi in 1905 that reveals that the proconsul of Achaia at that time was a man named Gallio. Another one, in Acts 19:22, Luke identifies a man named Erastus as one of Paul's helpers. It says that he was a city treasurer in Corinth. Again, a lot of scholars who are skeptical believe that the early church members were taken from lower classes of people and that no one would have held that kind of a position, and that there was no one named Erastus who is a city treasurer. In 1929, archaeologists excavated a first century street in Corinth. They found a stone laid 2,000 years ago by Erastus. The third word engraved on the stone was a word for a title of somebody who supervised the financial affairs of the city. In other words, in 1929, this stone that Erastus laid about 1,900 years earlier was still where he left it, and revealed that he had held the office that Luke had mentioned. So Luke's account was accurate. Another example, in Acts 18:2, it says that Emperor Claudius gave an order for all the Jews to leave Rome. Outside the Bible, a Roman historian named Suetonius wrote, because the Jews of Rome caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestius, which most scholars believe was another spelling of Christ, Claudius expelled them from the city. Now, Suetonius is a Latin name for Sue. If you've ever heard the old Johnny Cash song, A Boy Named Sue, this is where it came from. Not really. I'm just checking to make sure you're with me, okay? Just checking. Just want to make sure you're with me. But again, archaeology verifies that what we know historically from the Bible can be trusted. Bruce Feller wrote a New York Times bestseller a couple years ago called Walking the Bible. He does not have an evangelical faith, but it's a fascinating book because he goes to the Holy Land and he walks through where the Bible is set. And at one point, Bruce asks Eliezer Oren, who is perhaps the leading archaeologist in the world. He's at the University of Negev. And Feller asks Oren how his research has affected his evaluation of the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. And it's very interesting because Oren's response is that when he was just starting out and a younger man, he was a little rebellious. He didn't give the Hebrew Scriptures very much credence. But that the more he has gone on and done research, it has caused him to respect the Hebrew Scriptures. And at the end of their conversation, Bruce asks him, can you give the Old Testament a grade in terms of archaeological accuracy? And he writes, for the first time all morning, Oren grins and says, A++. Archaeology has verified what we see there. Okay? Now, reservation number two. The Bible is full of contradictions that undermine its own authority. That's a common one, isn't it? You've probably struggled with that. I've struggled with that. It's a real important concern, so we need to focus a little bit of attention on it. Here's an example of the kind of thing that's often discussed. In Matthew chapter 8, Matthew tells about a centurion who comes to Jesus and asks Jesus to heal his servant. Now, Luke tells the same story in Luke 7, only in Luke's version, the centurion sends a few elders, and they're the ones who put the question to Jesus. So there are certain writers or thinkers who say, well, see, this proves the Bible cannot be the word of God because it contradicts itself. Now, this gets into the nature of what kind of book the Bible is, and I don't think that's a right way of looking at it. In the first place, even in our day, different people will summarize stories in different ways. Or a reporter might say, the president announced today, when the words were actually written by a speechwriter and pronounced by a press secretary, right? But we all understand there are different ways of telling the story. It doesn't mean the story didn't happen. This is exactly the kind of gritty detail that makes the gospel accounts very compelling. Some skeptics believe that at some point, the writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, got together, they collaborated, they conspired, they said, hey, let's have this account of this guy who raises from the dead. But if they had, wouldn't they have ironed out those little differences? And so the fact that you find some of these little variances in the accounts is really gives credibility to what they're doing. Instead, what we find is what's known way back there in the Bible is recognized and put together. Matthew, Mark say there was, for example, one angel at the tomb. Luke and John say there were two. Matthew says Peter denied Jesus before the rooster crowed once. Mark says the rooster crowed two times. Furthermore, the Gospels say the first resurrection witnesses were women. Now, back in that day in the Jewish culture, women were not allowed to give testimony. They were not allowed to sit in a court and give their perspective because it was not considered valuable or legitimate. Okay? So, if you were going to make this up, why would you put women in the story as the first ones to experience the empty tomb? Because you know in that culture it's not going to be received. Doesn't make sense that they would put this all together. So it seems rather clear that the writers of the Gospels and then the early church in preserving them were scrupulous about preserving the actual eyewitness accounts. And all the eyewitnesses agree on what matters most, which is that Jesus rose from the dead. And you see that with any kind of historical account. This last week we celebrated the 10th anniversary of the tragedy of 9/11. It was interesting when we got to San Diego, it was 100 degrees. Those of you who told us about San Diego, you never mentioned that it could get to be 100 degrees. You said it was perfect weather. And so we get out there and they said, yeah, it's been this way for a couple days. It doesn't usually get this warm. And we got there on a Wednesday afternoon, evening. Thursday, we go out to the base, and about 1 o'clock, we get to be with Sam. We're walking around the base. And in the middle of the afternoon, all the power is lost on the base. And thought, well, that's kind of strange. Well, we get back to the hotel, and we find out that there's a blackout, and that parts of Southern California, Arizona, and New Mexico are all without power. And fortunately, there was a Walgreens next door that was letting people in, and a few at a time, and their employees would go around with flashlights and let you get a few necessities and pay by cash. But it was interesting, as the hotel kind of had a little grassy spot in the area, so we had a couple candles there, and we were picnicking with Aaron and Valerie. And it was interesting because the neighbors were talking about how this was the anniversary of 9/11, and that it was probably could be terrorists. And I was like, oh, come on, just relax. And it turned out it was just an overload of the system because they weren't used to having that kind of weather. But when we had the remembrances of 9/11, they showed many of the people who experienced it. And if you're paying attention, the accounts vary because people were standing in different places. They were looking at it from different angles, different perspectives. And so many of the accounts vary. They're not identical. But they all agree the towers came down. And just because their particular eyewitness experience is a little different from somebody else's doesn't discredit the experience. It just indicates that it was a different eyewitness account. In an investigation, sometimes we'll watch the shows on the upper channels where they've got, you know, the investigation of the crime that can't be solved and all these things. And when you have multiple witnesses that have identical stories, that's when the investigators get a little suspicious, because that lends itself to the idea that somebody's gotten together to make sure that their story adds up. It's when there's a little bit of difference in it that they understand it's just the different perspective of the eyewitnesses. That's what we see in the gospel accounts. And so from my perspective, that actually gives credibility to them rather than take it away. Because even though there are slight differences, they all agree the dead guy came out of the grave. And that's what matters. Reservation number 3. Are you with me so far? All right. Just a second while I get a drink of water. Reservation number 3. We no longer have the original copies of the manuscripts of the Bible, and therefore all kinds of errors or legends may have gotten written into the copies we have. A legitimate concern with anything that's written from that long ago. Anytime you have a literature from 2,000, 3,000 years ago, there's a concern. How do we know that what we have today is accurate? And basically, it comes down to a couple of things. It comes down to, number one, how many manuscripts of it do we have? Because obviously, the more that you have, the more likely it is to be accurate. And the other is, how closely to the actual events is the earliest manuscript? If the earliest manuscript is written 500 years after the event, then you don't have any eyewitnesses still alive. But if the first manuscripts are written within the first lifetime of people, then it's obviously a little more credible. Let me give you a rundown of some of our more reliable historical documents. These are things that you hear referred to that are not questioned in terms of are they trustworthy. Julius Caesar's The Gallic Wars. We have 10 relatively ancient manuscripts. The earliest of them, there's a 1,000-year gap between when Caesar died and when that manuscript was copied. Okay? Nobody questions the validity of it. Pliny the Younger's Natural History. We have 7 manuscripts, the earliest one 750 years after he died. Herodotus, does anybody know how to say that right? Herodotus, thank you. His history, we have 8 manuscripts. The earliest one is 1,350 years after he died. Tacitus, in the Annals, we have 20 ancient manuscripts. The oldest one, 1,000 years after he died. Okay? Twilight, we have over 1 million copies sold, which is irrelevant but tragic. I just don't understand. I don't get it. But anyway, when it comes to the New Testament text, Bruce Metzger is a Princeton scholar, and he notes, we have 5,664 Greek manuscripts going way back within decades of the life of Jesus. Add to that another 8,000 to 10,000 Latin Vulgate manuscripts, another 8,000 or so Ethiopian, Slavic, Armenian, over 24,000 manuscripts in existence. Okay? That's the New Testament. the Old Testament. It's kind of interesting. A century ago, the earliest Old Testament manuscript we had was from about 900 A.D., 900 years after Christ, almost a millennia after the New Testament was written. Then a big find in the mid-20th century. Has anyone ever heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Heard reference to that? They were found in a place in the world near the Dead Sea. Okay? That was not a trick question. It really, by the Dead Sea, they called them the Dead Sea Scrolls. Biggest significance of the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and any scholar would tell you this, was the remarkable similarity between the text in the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the book of Isaiah, and the copies that we have that were written that 900 years later. Okay? They were remarkably accurate. Not just that, 100 years ago or so, again, there were skeptics who argued that the Hebrew religion and scriptures were not solidified, didn't get written down until about 300 B.C. So in other words, they were really legend, didn't really happen, okay? But it was significant 100 years ago. Then in 1979, a man named Gabriel Barque found one archaeological review called one of the 10 biggest finds in the 20th century. Two pieces of rolled silver the size of cigarette butts. Because they were so old, it took them 3 years to unfold them. I can't imagine having that kind of patience. I don't look for socks for more than 2 minutes. But for 3 years, it took them 3 years to unroll this, and another 3 years to treat them with chemicals so that they could read them. The first word they read was the word Yahweh. This was from the great blessing in the book of Numbers. The Lord bless you and keep you. And it was on documents 2,600 years old. In other words, the text already existed 400 years before skeptics said it had even been written. All of this to say that there is simply no document of antiquity in the same category as the scriptures when it comes to manuscript evidence and support. So the idea that it can't be trusted because it's been so long ago just doesn't hold up. There's too much manuscript support, okay? Those are three of the more common reservations that people have. I hope that was challenging for you, gave you something to think about, reaffirmed where you were, or challenged you to go a little bit deeper, depending on where you are in your journey. Next week, we're going to address four more common reservations that people have in terms of being able to put trust in Scripture and trust in God, okay? Father, we thank you that you love us, that you delight us, that you have called us to be part of your story of redemption. Father, as we take these weeks to explore certain reservations that people have, legitimate, good, honest questions, we ask that your Spirit would lead and guide every single one of us, no matter where we are in our journey, so that we might objectively and thoughtfully examine the evidence, that we might come to re-examine where we are in terms of putting our trust in you. We thank you for all of this in Jesus' precious name.